Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Headless Horror by Robert Eugene Ulmer. What makes my hand tremble so? You wonder why one so young should appear so old and haggard? And the gray in my hair, the lines on my face? Perhaps, too, you notice a furtive, haunted manner about my movements. Nervousness, my friends. You would like to hear about it? Well then, gentlemen, I shall tell you the story, for the rain is beating without, and we cannot travel in such weather. Come closer and hug the fire, for the tale of the Headless Horror will make your blood run cold. You must understand that I have always been very superstitious, with a marked tendency towards spiritualism in the pursuit of weird ambitions and hobbies. One of these, in my younger days, involved a human head, that of a murderer famed in history, the assassin of a national figure. This murderer had been hanged, and the head, horribly severed, was sent to the government for preservation. It happened that I was the proprietor of an embryo museum, and when I heard of the head, I resolved to add it to my collection, foreseeing the big help it would mean for my institution. However, I had competition. One of my friends engaged in the same work also desired the head, so we both set out together, each resolved to possess the prize. There was nothing of bitterness in our relations, for Bergman and I had been associated in friendly intercourse for many years and always maintained sincere mutual regard. Our common desire at this time partook of good-natured rivalry and nothing of ill will. The one who obtained the head would have the other's good wishes. We came to our destination. After much formality and red tape, we finally were permitted to view the head, preserved in a large jar of alcohol. The murderer in life had been a pronounced brunette, with a silken mustache glistening like a raven's back, brows of fierce concentration and force, and hair that was thick and wavy. He had been a handsome fellow, evidently, but the action of the preservative had turned the countenance to a ghastly yellow hue. The hair, brows, and mustache were a faded henna. What made the thing more repulsive was that the container was too small for the head, and the nose was pressed flat against the glass, while the staring eyes had taken on a watery, colorless complexion. The neck, crudely severed and mangled, was marked with swollen and burst arteries, while sections of the windpipe and other organs streamed from the ragged edges, floating gently in the fluid. I regarded the object with superstitious veneration. I confess, too, a creepy sensation and a strengthening of my occult sensibilities. We then opened our subject. It was days before we persuaded the government officials to listen favorably, but they at last decided to sell the head to the highest bidder. Bergman waged a hard fight, but I won eventually, and my competitor shook my hand good-naturedly, smiling to conceal his disappointment. We parted on the best of terms. When I returned, I took my treasure into the laboratory to prepare it later for display and locked it in a cabinet, resolving to sleep and live in the building. I could run no risk of losing my valuable acquisition. For some time following, I gave myself up to a prolonged study of the history of the man whose head I now possessed, and in the course of my reading was startled to find reference to a threat made by the condemned murderer that he would return after death and claim his head, no matter where or with whom it chanced to be. The threat was regarded, of course, as the child of a disordered mind, but upon me it produced a deep and lasting impression. The head assumed new significance, and night after night have I, surrounded by freaks and strange objects of all kinds, sat in silent meditation, gazing intently into the grotesquely distorted features of that long-dead criminal, and striving to fathom the secrets entombed within that grisly skull. I found myself looking forward confidently to the fulfillment of the murderer's prophecy. At every trifling sound, I started. Ordinary events were cloaked in mystery and ominous import. I saw and heard things that no other mortal recognized until I felt myself tottering on the verge of madness. There was one other person, incidentally, to whom the head was an object of superstitious terror. This was my only assistant, an old man who had been in the family for years, and the one being outside of myself who knew that I possessed the head. Moses never looked at it without a rising of every hair on his cranium. One night, I retired as usual, amid the fantastic relics of my collection, to my bed in a dark corner of the building. The moonlight shone through the window and relieved the darkness with ghostly luminescence through which strange faces peered and leered at me from other nooks and crevices. Grotesque mummies seemed to live again in a mysterious atmosphere, holding silent communion. With all this, I believed my state of mind to be normal. My nerves were keyed to highest tension. Sleep was wooed with difficulty, and my eyes constantly wandered to the cabinet wherein was the head. From the partial darkness of its confinement, the face seemed to stare at me with a leering grin, jeering silently at my apprehension. In that moment, I heartily wished that the murderer would return and claim the thing. As the night wore along and sleep still did not come, I arose. As I did so, I noticed a strange quality in the air. Some occult sense was around me and seemed to respond to a quality I could not define. Puzzled, I glanced around. I was alone, save for Moses, sleeping soundly in his corner bed. All was as usual, nothing missing nor misplaced. The sensation grew until I was conscious of a subtle, unseen presence somewhere close at hand. Long before I saw or heard anything of the horror that followed, I sensed its approach and was waiting. When I finally heard the closing of a door, though the sound was guarded, I concealed myself in a dark recess and waited. Every sense, physical and occult, alert, convinced that the murderer had come. A thrill shuddered through me, but I waited silently, my eyes fastened upon the door through which the unseen must enter. In the passage outside, all was semi-gloom. Then I saw, oh God, with a wave of horror, a huge misshapen form before the entrance. Nothing of it was definite, and its vague impression of general deformity made me shiver. Where the head should have been, I discerned nothing but a shapeless mass of heavy shroud. And it was this amorphous quality, this indefiniteness of form and feature, this quality of shapelessness, that struck mortal terror to my soul. I trembled in apprehension and was bathed in icy perspiration. Meanwhile, the silent thing without was preparing to enter. The thought of being in the same room with it wakened a frenzy of horror in me, and I wildly burst from my concealment, staggered blindly through the gloom, waving a revolver, and made for the horror. But before I reached the door, the object of my frenzy disappeared as if by magic. The shrouded form seemed to melt into the surrounding darkness, and when I dashed into the corridor, it was empty. I was fully convinced now of the sincerity of the murderer's dying threat, and held not the slightest doubt as to the identity of my midnight visitor. But I resolved to fight for the possession of the head. I thought it might cost my life. Just how I was to battle against the terrible and subtle powers of the supernatural, I had no definite idea, but I distinctly recall making an expedition the following evening into town and purchasing a supply of ammunition. It was not yet 7 o'clock when I left, and I promised Moses I would not be long, for he dreaded the idea of being alone with that hideous head. However, the news of my adventure had preceded me, through what medium I do not know, and I was forced to retell an account of it to every person that waylaid me. By the time I returned, it was well past 11, and silence had long since settled over the little rural community. Just As I was within half a square of the museum, a dreadful cry of mortal terror rang upon the air. I burst into a run. The first thing I saw, on dashing into the building, was Moses, struggling to his feet. His face was livid, and his eyes were staring wildly, as if he had seen a ghost. His knees knocked, and it was some time before he could speak coherently. "Oh, Lord, Lord," he groaned, with chattering teeth. "I've seen the devil. He bust in here about 15 minutes ago and waked me up, all wrapped in black, so I could see his face. He rushed right past me, and he knocked poor Moses to the floor. He's in the museum." I waited for no more, but burst into the museum. What I saw halted me in horror. My visitor of the preceding night stood before the cabinet, and in the gloom I could see that his hands were opening the locked doors, and then they lifted their head, jar and all, from the shelf. As if unconscious of my presence, the hideous thing removed the cover, plunged its shrouded hands into the alcohol, and dragged forth the head dripping and clammy. Fascinated, I saw the concealing shroud fall away, and beheld with a thrill the ragged, gory base upon which a head once rested. There stood the awful object, so grotesque in its headless being, proceeding about its work with the method and surety of a normal man, nothing of halting in its movement, for it seemed that hidden eyes directed them. But when I saw the head lifted and set upon the gory base, my horror at the fantastic sight forced a cry from my lips. The figure started, and carried that swiftly to the pit of its arm, protecting it evidently from any onslaught of mine, and then came towards me menacingly. All my valiant determination fled. Utterly unnerved, I turned and sped like the wind, the horrible thing pursuing. The building was 3 stories in height. We were on the first floor. Up the steps I dashed, turning frequently to see my awful pursuer gliding, rather than running swiftly after me, with the dogged determination of a grim messenger of death. In the pit of an arm, the head rested, and I thought its sightless eyes were fixed upon me, and were directing the shrouded body in its pursuit. Not a sound from the flying feet, nothing to indicate the slightest human quality. I dashed ever upward, from step to step, my voice paralyzed by fear. How interminably long each flight of stairs seemed. Though the entire affair did not, I suppose, occupy more than 15 minutes, it was an eternity of terror to me. I fled blindly on, and it followed relentlessly, until the roof was reached. I fled its length, but was forced to halt at the edge. There was no other roof adjacent, and I could not jump the 3 stories without being killed. Death was both before and behind me, and in a flash I chose the latter. Whirling like a wolf at bay, I faced the grim phantom bearing down upon me savagely. I threw out my revolver hand, though mechanically realizing that shots could have no effect upon a thing of spirit, and fired once, twice, 3 times. Blinded and temporarily deranged by fear, I failed at first to note the halt of my enemy as my first shot rang out. After pressing the trigger for the last time, I saw the deformed horror sway, stagger, and then crash heavily to the roof. A strange sound of splintering wood penetrated my dazed faculties, and amazed, I stood staring at the fallen figure as it uttered a strangled groan and relapsed into deathly silence. When I finally plucked up sufficient courage, I bent, drew back a fold of the heavy shroud, and started away in horror. Before me was the face of Bergman, my old competitor, distorted in death's agony. In a flash, I saw it all. The utter duplicity of the man, his clever deceit, and the subtle trick upon my superstitious nature, by which he hoped to possess the head. The false shoulders he had worn were of wood, very light, painted realistically, crushed in the fall. The head I returned to the government. The museum I deserted. I'm a nervous wreck. Such is the tale of the Headless Horror. The Sea Curse by Robert E. Howard. And some return by the failing light, and some in the waking dream, for she hears the heels of the dripping ghosts that ride the rough room beam. Rudyard Kipling. They were the brawlers and braggarts, the loud boasters and hard drinkers of Farringtown, John Colrick and his crony Lilip Canool. Many a time have I, a tousled-haired lad, stolen to the tavern door to listen to their curses, their profane arguments, and wild sea songs, half fearful and half in admiration of these wild rovers. I, all the people of Faringtown, gazed on them with fear and admiration, for they were not like the rest of the faring men. They were not content to ply their trade along the coasts as among the shark-teeth shoals. No yawls, no skiffs for them. They fared far, further than any other man in the village, for they shipped on the great sailing ships that went out on the white tides to brave the restless grey ocean and make ports in strange lands. Oh, I mind it was swift times in the little seacoast village of Faring, when John Coolreck came home with his furtive lilip at his side, swaggering down the gangplank in his tarry sea clothes and the broad leather belt that held his ever-ready dagger, shouting condescending greetings to some favorite acquaintance, kissing some maiden who ventured too near, then up the street, roaring some scarcely decent song of the sea. How the cringers and the idlers, the hangers-on, would swarm about the two desperate heroes, flattering and smirking, guffawing hilariously at each nasty jest. For to the tavern loafers, and to some of the weaker among the straightforward villagers, these men, with their wild talk and their brutal deeds, their tales of the seven seas and the far countries, these men, I say, were valiant knights, nature's noblemen who dared to be men of blood and brawn. And all feared them, so that when a man was beaten or a woman insulted, the villagers muttered and did nothing. And so when Moll Farrell's niece was put to shame by John Coolreck, none dared even to put in words what all thought. Moll had never married, and she and the girl lived alone in a little hut, down close to the beach, so close that in high tide the waves came almost to the door. The people of the village accounted old Moll something of a witch, and she was a grim, gaunt old dame who had little to say to anyone, but she minded her own business and eked out a slim living by gathering clams and picking up bits of driftwood. The girl was a pretty, foolish little thing, vain and easily befooled, else she had never yielded to the shark-like blandishments of John Coolreck. I mind the day was cold. It was winter, with a sharp breeze out of the east, and the old dame came into the village street shrieking that the girl had vanished, all scattered over the beach and back among the bleak inland hills to search for her, all save John Coolreck and his cronies, who sat in the tavern dicing and toping. All the while beyond the shoals we heard the never-ceasing droning of the heaving, restless grey monster, and in the dim light of the ghostly dawn, Moll Farrell's girl came home. The tides bore her gently across the wet sands, and later almost at her own door. Virgin white she was, and her arms were folded across her still bosom. Calm was her face, and the grey tides sighed about her slender limbs. Moll Farrell's eyes were stones, yet she stood above her dead girl, and spoke no word till John Coolreck and his crony came reeling down from the tavern, their drinking jack still in their hands. Drunk was John Coolreck, and the people gave back for him, murder in their souls, so he came and laughed at Moll Farrell across the body of the girl. "Zounds," swore John Coolreck, "the wench has drowned herself." "Lilip?" Lilip laughed with a twist of his thin mouth. He always hated Moll Farrell, for it was she that had given him the name of Lilip. Then John Coolreck lifted his drinking jack, swaying on his uncertain legs. "A health to the wench's ghost," he bellowed, while all stood aghast. Then Moll Farrell spoke, and the words broke from her in a scream which sent ripples of cold up and down the spines of the thong. "The curse of the foul fiend upon you, John Coolreck," she screamed. "The curse of God rest upon your vile soul throughout eternity. May you gaze on sights that shall sear the eyes of you and scorch the soul of you. May you die a bloody death and writhe in hell's flames for a million and a million and yet a million years. I curse you by sea and by land, by earth and by air, by the demon of the oceans and the demons of the swamplands, the fiends of the forest and the goblins of the hills. And you," lean finger stabbed at Lilip Canuel, and he started backward, his face paling, "you shall be the death of John Coolreck, and he shall be the death of you. You shall bring John Coolrick to the doors of hell, and John Coolrick shall bring you to the gallows tree. I set the seal of death upon your brow, John Coolrick. You shall live in terror and die in horror, far out upon the cold gray sea. But the sea that took the soul of innocence to her bosom shall not take you, but shall fling forth your vile carcass to the sands. Aye, John Coolrick. And she spoke with such a terrible intensity that the drunken mockery on the man's face changed to one of swinish stupidity. The sea roars for the victims it will not keep. There is snow upon the hills, John Coolrick, and ere it melts your corpse will lie at my feet, and I shall spit upon it and be content. Coolrick and his crony sailed at dawn for a long voyage, and Moll went back to her hut and her clam gathering. She seemed to grow leaner and more grim than ever, and her eyes smoldered with a light not sane. The days glided by, and people whispered among themselves that Moll's days were numbered, for she faded to a ghost of a woman, but she went her way, refusing all aid. That was a short, cold summer, and the snow on the barren inland hills never melted, a thing very unusual, which caused much comment among the villagers. At dusk and at dawn, Moll would come back up on the beach, gaze up at the snow which glittered on the hills, then out to sea, with a fierce intensity in her gaze. Then the days grew shorter, the nights longer and darker, and the cold gray tides came sweeping along the bleak strands, bearing the rain and sleet of the sharp east breezes. And upon a bleak day, a trading vessel sailed into the bay and anchored. And all the idlers and the wastrels flocked to the wharves, for that was the ship upon which John Coolrick and Lilip Canoole had sailed. Down the gangplank came Lilip, more furtive than ever, but John Coolrick was not there. To shouted inquiries, Canoole shook his head. Coolrick deserted ship at a port of Sumatra, said he. He had a row with the skipper, lads. Wanted me to desert too, but no. I had to see you fine lads again, right, boys? Almost cringing was Lilip Canoole, and suddenly recoiled as Moll Farrell came through the throng. A moment they stood eyeing each other. Then Moll's grim lips bent in the terrible smile. There's blood on your hand, Canoole, she lashed out suddenly, so suddenly that Lilip started and rubbed his right hand across his left sleeve. Stand aside, witch, he snarled in sudden anger, striding through the crowd which gave back for him. His admirers followed him to the tavern. Now, I mind that the next day was even colder. Gray fogs came drifting out of the east and veiled the sea and the beaches. There would be no sailing that day, and so all the villagers were in their snug houses or matching tales at the tavern. So it came about that Joe, my friend, a lad of my own age, and I were the ones who saw the first of the strange thing that happened. Being harum-scarum lads of no wisdom, we were sitting in a small rowboat, floating at the end of the wharf, each shivering and wishing the other was to just leaving, there being no reason whatever for our being there. Say that it was a good place to build air castles undisturbed. Suddenly Joe raised his hand. Say, he said, do you hear? Who can be out on the bay upon a day like this? Nobody. What you hear? Oars. Or I'm a lubber. Listen. There was no seeing anything in that fog, and I heard nothing. Yet Joe swore he did, and suddenly his face assumed a strange look. Somebody rowing out there, I tell you. The bay is alive with oars from the sound. A score of boats, at the least. You dolt, can you not hear? Then as I shook my head, he leaped and began to undo the painter. I'm off to sea. Name me liar if the bay is not full of boats, all together like a close fleet. Are you with me? Yes, I was with him, though I heard nothing. Then out in the grayness we went, and the fog closed behind and before, so that we drifted in a vague world of smoke, seeing not and hearing not. We were lost in no time, and I cursed Joe for leading us upon a wild goose chase that was like to end with our being swept out to sea. I thought of Moll Farrell's girl and shuddered. How long we drifted, I know not. Minutes faded into hours, hours into centuries. Still Joe swore he heard the oars now close at hand, now far away. For hours we followed them, steering our course toward the sound as the noise grew or receded. This I later thought of and could not understand. Then my hands were so numb that I could no longer hold the oar, and the forerunning drowsiness of cold and exhaustion was stealing over me. Bleak white stars broke through the fog, which glided suddenly away, fading like a ghost of smoke, and we found ourselves afloat just outside the mouth of the bay. The waters lay smooth as a pond, all dark green and silver in the starlight, and the cold came crisper than ever. I was swinging the boat about to put back into the bay when Joe gave a shout, and for the first time I heard the clack of oarlocks. I glanced over my shoulder, and my blood went cold. A great beak prow loomed above us, a weird, unfamiliar shape against the stars, and as I caught my breath, sheered sharply and swept by us, with a curious swishing I had never heard any other craft make. Joe screamed and backed oars frantically, and the boat walled out of the way, just in time, for though the prow had missed us, still otherwise we had died. From the sides of the ship stood long oars, bank upon bank, which swept her along. Though I had never seen such a craft, I knew her for a galley. But what was she doing upon our coast? They said, the farfarers, that such ships were still in use among the heathens of Barbary, but it was many a long, heaving mile to Barbary, and even so, she did not resemble the ships described by those who had sailed far. We started in pursuit, and this was strange, for though the water broke about her prow, and she seemed fairly to fly through the waves, yet she was making little speed, and it was no time before we caught up with her. Making our painter fast to a chain far back, beyond the reach of the swishing oars, we hailed those on deck, but there came no answer, and at last, conquering our fears, we clambered up the chain and found ourselves upon the strangest deck man has trod for many a long, roaring century. "This is no Barbary Rover," muttered Joe fearsomely. "Look, how old this seems, almost ready to fall to pieces. Why, 'tis fairly rotten." There was no one on deck, no one at the long sweep with which the craft was steered. We stole to the hold and looked down the stairs. Then and there, if ever men were on the verge of insanity, it was we. For there were rowers there, it is true. They sat upon the rower's bench and drove the creaking oars through the gray waters. And that they rowed were skeletons. Shrieking, we plunged across the deck to fling ourselves into the sea. But at the rail I tripped upon something and fell headlong, and as I lay I saw a thing which vanquished my fear of the horrors below for an instant. The thing upon which I had tripped was a human body, and in the dim gray light that was beginning to steal across the eastern waves I saw a dagger hilt standing up between his shoulders. Joe was at the rail, urging me to haste, and together we slid down the chain and cut the painter. Then we stood off into the bay. Straight on kept the grim galley, and we followed. Slowly wondering, she seemed to be heading straight for the beach beside the wharfs, and as we approached, we saw the wharfs thronged with people. They had missed us, no doubt, and now they stood there in the early dawn light, struck dumb by the apparition which had come up out of the night and the grim ocean. Straight on swept the galley, her oars aswish, then ere she reached the shallow water, crash! A terrific reverberation shook the bay. Before our eyes the grim craft seemed to melt away. Then she vanished, and the green waters seethed where she had ridden. But there floated no driftwood there, nor did there ever float any ashore. Aye, something floated ashore, but it was grim driftwood. We made the landing amid a hum of excited conversation that stopped suddenly. Moll Farrell stood before her hut, limbed gauntly against the ghostly dawn, her lean hand pointing seaward. And across the sighing wet sand, borne by the great tide, something came floating, something that the waves dropped at Moll Farrell's feet, and there looked up at us as we crowded about, a pair of unseeing eyes set in a still white face. John Coolrec had come home. Still and grim he lay, rocked by the tide, and as he lurched sideways, all saw the dagger hilt that stood from his back. The dagger all of us had seen a thousand times at the belt of Lie-Lip Canoel. I killed him, came Canoel's shriek, as he writhed and grovelled before our gaze. At sea, on a still night, in a drunken brawl, I slew him and hurled him overboard, and from the far seas he has followed me, His voice sank to a hideous whisper. Because of the curse, the sea would not keep his body. And the wretch sank down, trembling, the shadow of the gallows already in his eyes. "I," strong, deep, and exultant, was Moll Farrell's voice. "From the hell of lost craft Satan sent a ship of bygone ages, a ship red with gore and stained with the memory of horrid crimes. None other would bear such a vile carcass. The sea has taken vengeance and has given me mine. See now how I spit upon the face of John Coolrec." And with a ghastly laugh she pitched forward, the blood starting to her lips, and the sun came up across the restless sea.